Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to the Cynical Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, produced in partnership with SubChina. SubChina is simply the best way there is to keep on top of all the important news coming out of China. Our indispensable daily newsletter features a roundup of the news from hundreds of sources, plus links to the original pieces we feature on our website. Sign up for SubChina Access, and you get all that and much more with stories on everything from the Belt and Road to local entrepreneurship and innovation in China, from the travails of ethnically Chinese researchers in the U.S. in this age of creeping McCarthyism, to China's ongoing extra-legal internment of hundreds of thousands, or by some estimates, over 1 million Uyghurs and other Muslims in China's Xinjiang region. We're sure you'll agree that it's a feast of business, political, and cultural news about a nation that is reshaping the world. I'm Kaiser Guo, and I am in Washington, D.C. today at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, CSIS. Jeremy Goldkorn was supposed to join from Nashville, but he instructed me to say that in a July phone call he had with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, he never once promised free sub-China access subscriptions in exchange for an investigation into a certain rival China newsletter editor. But he says, hey, he'll be back next week. The transcripts will be, or the partial transcript will be available.
Summary of the transcript.
Right, the summary of the transcript, inshallah. As we near the end of September, demonstrations in Hong Kong that began in earnest in June will soon be entering their fifth month. And while in the last couple of weekends we've seen some diminution in intensity and in the numbers of participants, they are by no means at an end. We've had the pleasure on this program of speaking twice with Anthony Dapperan, who's written a book on the history of Hong Kong's protest. And he gave us a great on-the-ground perspective on what was happening earlier in the summer. But today we're going to look at some additional perspectives on the situation in the special administrative region. So today we'll hear the views of some of this leaderless movement's more prominent figures, five of whom were actually here at CSIS recently. They're making the rounds in D.C. We'll talk about U.S. policy options with Hong Kong and one piece of legislation in particular now that's moving through Congress, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. We'll consider Xi Jinping's apparent inaction on Hong Kong to date and talk about what he might have done and still might do. We're also going to look at what shapes the attitudes of many mainlanders toward Hong Kong and why not only has there been an absence of sympathy or empathy, but actually apathy or even downright antipathy. That's a lot of pathies toward Hong Kong protesters. We've seen even in communities in diaspora in many cities around the world. And we will talk about press coverage of the demonstrations from the PRC media, the so-called Western media, and outlets like the South China Morning Post, and lots of important issues related to media coverage. So to talk through all of this, I have come to CSIS today with the express purpose to consult with its newly minted Freeman Chair, a dear old friend of our podcast, the wise and deeply informed, all-around swell dude, Jude Blanchette. Jude, man, welcome back to the show, and thanks for hosting us here today.
Thank you very much, Kaiser. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us first about this new gig of yours, this Freeman Chair at CSIS. It is named, I assume, for the illustrious Chaz Freeman Jr.?
It is not.
It is not.
No, it is not.
It should be, damn it.
So, no, this is the Freeman Chair, which dates back to the early 1990s, is named after the Freeman family. But there is undoubtedly there's some perception there that Chaz Freeman Jr. is was related to it, but his son actually held the Freeman Chair.
Oh, wow.
So Charles Thus Freeman
doubling
was,
the confusion.
Yes, doubling the confusion. So Charles Freeman was the Freeman Chair in the aughts.
Ah, okay, right. Father and son both, and the daughter I'm huge fans of, as we all know. So what is the Freeman Chair? What is it that you do besides a lot of fundraising?
So the Freeman Chair is just one center of China activities here at CSIS. We have a lot going on. Bonnie Glazer and the China Power Project, Scott Kennedy, who I'm sure many listeners know, who's now at the new trustee chair for Chinese business and economics. Mm-hmm. Freeman Chair, we're going to be focusing on party governance. Mm-hmm. So attempting to understand the internal workings of the Communist Party, but also looking at Chinese domestic policy for its own sake, recognizing that China, as a country that deserves a focus on policy development and social developments in the country, not only as they pertain to U.S.-China relations, but because it's just important for its own sake.
Well, we are always happy to see when members of our secret cabal move into the corridors of power. So congrats, Matt, on the new gig.
Thank you very much.
So Jude, let's start with this visit last week. You had five prominent Hong Kong activists, three of them I know fairly well. I think you hosted Denise Ho. I don't know how she pronounces her name. Ho?
Denise Ho, yes.
Okay. I mean, I don't even know what it is in Chinese, but Denise Ho, Joshua Wong, and Nathan Law here at CSIS. Now, in case some of our listeners haven't been following Hong Kong too closely, maybe we should ID them. I mean, Denise Ho is probably, well, she's very well known, obviously. She's a singer and an actor who's not just been active on behalf of Hong Kong, but also, you know, has been a real leader, probably the first prominent celebrity to come out. And she's been working on LGBTQ+ rights. Of course, Joshua Wong, everyone knows, he was the very young student activist who founded Scholarism and De Masisto. And he was jailed in 2017, but released right sort of before the crest of the current demonstrations in a very timely release that was in June of this year. What about Nathan Law? You want to talk a little bit about Nathan?
Yeah, Nathan Law, who also came to prominence in the umbrella protests in 2014 and was elected as a member of LegCo. And the youngest ever, but was has his seat stripped and spent some time in jail and is now studying for a master's at Yale University. And just quickly, the two other individuals we had were Brian Leong, who was a folks will remember after the demonstrators stormed LegCo, he was the protester who stood up and took his mask off,
right.
Show his face. And Jeffrey Ngo, who's a PhD student here in Georgetown, but is also at De Masisto.
Okay, right. Jeffrey's giving a talk tonight. He's one of Jim Millward's students, I know.
Okay.
Right.
For think tank collegiality, I must stress that this came by way of another helpful think tank here in D.C., which was hosting them. I'm not sure if that's public knowledge, so I'll leave the name off, but just want to say it was their help that we got them over here to do the podcast last Friday.
An anonymous shout out. What brings them to the States? Is it that they're trying to drum up support in Washington for the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, or just basically to bolster American support for their cause more broadly?
Yeah, it's a crucial moment for the protesters, with a lot of students going back to school, and a feeling that there was some of the momentum behind the protest was abating a little bit. You start to see momentum here in Washington, D.C. for the passage of, as you mentioned, this Human Rights and Democracy Act. I'll get to that in a minute, but just to say that the five individuals were holding a series of meetings across town, Speaker Pelosi, most prominent of which, to try and push for increased support in the United States, both at a symbolic level, but also in terms of passage of the bill. And I should say, if you saw President Trump's speech yesterday at the UN, he was using language that was his most sophisticated to date on the situation in Hong Kong and what the U.S. policy was or expectations were for China. So I should say that if the visits last week were an attempt to raise the awareness level here in Washington, D.C., it's certainly done that.
Let's talk a little bit about this bill, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, the HKHRDA. It's a bill that was introduced by Representative Chris Smith and by Senator Marco Rubio, if I'm not mistaken, both Republicans. What's the progress of the bill? What does it actually do? What does it actually commit the United States to? Or what would it?
Yeah, so the bill in its current form was introduced earlier in the summer, just after the protests had started. But I should say this is not the first time that the bill has been introduced. It was originally written in response to the umbrella protests in 2014. But probably because of the petering out of the umbrella protests and because U.S.-China relations were at a much different point way, 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 way back a couple years ago, the bill didn't get much traction,
right,
but was revived earlier this summer. And A key piece of legislation we have to talk about if we're going to make sense of this one is there was a Hong Kong Policy Act, which was originally passed in 1992.
Right.
Remember, that's a period just after 1989. The U.S. government was looking to put some sanctions in place and wanted to carve out Hong Kong and protect its status, essentially keep it free from any collateral damage. And so the Policy Act created or treated Hong Kong as a separate, essentially gave it a separate trading status.
That's right.
So it would be treated separately from any sanctions or tariffs, for example, that would be placed on mainland China. Hong Kong would be exempt for those. It was understood starting in 2014 that that status was potential leverage for the United States as it was trying to change China's calculation on Hong Kong. And so at the core of this, at the core of the Human Rights and Democracy Act is the possibility of revoking that status. It would give the U.S. government would annually review developments in Hong Kong, and if it determined that there had been a significant erosion of Beijing's pledge to give a high degree of autonomy and treat Hong Kong separately, in other words, if Hong Kong started to be de facto and de jure treated just another city in mainland China, then you would stop treating it as a separate entity.
Right. That makes sense.
The bill goes further than that, though. It also looks to potentially put sanctions on specific individuals in Hong Kong who are denying the rights of the protesters to peacefully demonstrate. And then again, this annual review that the U.S. government will do to evaluate developments in Hong Kong. But really, it's the revocation of the separate status of Hong Kong in terms of customs duties that would be, some are calling it the nuclear option.
Right. So, Jude, is it your sense that these young people, these five people who are here, have a clear idea of what they're getting into as they wade into American politics? Do you think they have a realistic sense of what the U.S. might actually be able to do on behalf of their cause? Or are they maybe overestimating how much of a white knight the Trump administration or Congress even could be?
Yeah, I think this is even folks here in D.C. have a hard time understanding the politics of D.C. So to the expectation that these individuals are going to have an accurate read on the evolving politics, not only in terms of Republicans and Democrats, but just the politics of China, of which clearly this bill is a part of the overall shifting in the United States in terms of how we think about China. But their calculus, I think, is any attention is good attention. If the pressure is going to stay on Beijing and if momentum is going to continue to build on the streets in Hong Kong, where it's most important, the symbolism of U.S. support, even if it's a statement like Trump said yesterday, without much of a strategy behind it, would still be a welcome addition of pressure on Beijing.
So I haven't had a chance to listen to the podcast that you actually did, right, accompanying the event. But maybe you could talk a little bit about what some of the highlights from their visit were and tell us as candidly as your natural tact will allow what you made of each of them.
How do I give you my assessment politely? So first of all, I want to say that it's extraordinary to have a group like this who's able and who's doing this much on a world stage with this much scrutiny.
Mm-hmm.
And these are, with the exception of Denise Ho, these are individuals who are just kind of in college age, if that. And so to have an individual like Joshua Wong, for example, who gets most of the media attention, but before he came here, he was detained in Hong Kong, then went to Taiwan, and then went to Germany, where he met with the foreign minister. An individual of his age, that's pretty extraordinary. I certainly thought that there was a differing degrees of perspective amongst the group,
mm-hmm.
and that some were articulating a vision that I think was much more about longer-term issues of Hong Kong's full and eventual return to the mainland China, and that was really where their eye was focused. And then there were others who were thinking more tactically about just getting through the next couple months and how do we shape Beijing's playbook in such a way that we have a higher likelihood of getting more of the demands through Beijing. And I think that's, as they said in the podcast, the real crucial issue for all of them is, how's Beijing going to potentially intervene or act over the next couple months? And I think that's an extraordinarily volatile situation. So, you know, looking at this at the macro level, you've got a Hong Kong government which is, I think, confused and indecisive. You have a group of protesters who themselves are, you know, you've got various factions within the protest movement. It's leaderless, but you have individuals like Joshua Wong who are symbolically the head of it. You have a U.S., you know, you have an administration here which hasn't taken the clearest stand on the issue of Hong Kong. You've got developments in Taiwan where this is playing into the election there. So all in all, this is a really volatile situation that these individuals are weighing in on.
And you actually put that question quite directly to Joshua Wong, asking him about 2047. What was his response?
Yeah, this is one where it's tied up with how you how you're thinking about this issue about what happens to Hong Kong after 2047 is really an issue about where you expect China to be in 2047. I think it's clear that Joshua has a fairly pessimistic outlook mm-hmm. on where China is today, let alone to where it's going to be in the next couple decades. So I think his strategy is to speak to the values argument here in the United States and really try and play up the idea of China as a more dictatorial actor that is fundamentally at odds with quote-unquote Western values.
Just to make sure that people know where they can find that podcast, the podcast is called Hong Kong on the Brink.
Indeed, on the CSIS website.
Right. And you can download it presumably just from any old from iTunes or what have you, right? Great. Let's shift now to talk about Beijing and Xi Jinping in particular. Xi must be aware of how, as you suggested, Hong Kong has had just such an impact on so many of the other issues that China is now facing. Just now you mentioned Taiwan, which is approaching an election. It's certainly, I think, maybe given quite a bit of impetus to Tsai Ing-wen and to the Greens. There's a tie-in, I think, to American attitudes, certainly global attitudes, really, when it comes to Xinjiang and the atrocity happening there right now, and a whole host of other problems that Beijing is now confronting. Can you talk about the way that these issues now touch on one another and how that might be affecting Beijing's thinking when it comes to Hong Kong?
Yeah, there's certainly a fungibility of these issues where I'm not sure Beijing understands just how connected these are in terms of the discussion here in the United States, you know, wherein events that are transpiring in Xinjiang are certainly affecting the calculus of demonstrators in Hong Kong who are thinking about folks on the margin who were maybe unsure about where they stood on the question of 2047 or even before are now suddenly confronting developments up in the northwest of China, which are, as you said, are horrifying and certainly impact the way that you think about what that eventual formal and full reunification will look like in 2047. You know, events that are happening in Hong Kong then are ricocheting through Taiwan. And all of these are acting as catalysts here in the United States for existing frustrations and tensions, and really in some specific cases are acting like rocket boosters.
Right.
And so this is making an already complicated situation for Beijing even more complicated. And I think what it speaks to is maybe not that they don't understand the fungibility of these, but really what we're talking about is several issues that touch core political concerns of Beijing are all flaring up at the same time.
Right.
So all of these are territorial security issues: Taiwan, Hong Kong, Xinjiang. Right. Mm-hmm. These are all the absolute core baselines, and they're all happening at a time when China's political system is undergoing some pretty significant transformations, as we see it pretty rapidly move towards a more decentralized decision-making or collective decision-making model into a more centralized decision-making model where Xi Jinping is the bottleneck of all bottlenecks in many ways mm-hmm. and is fighting multiple fires at the same time. I didn't even mention U.S.-China trade.
Right, of course.
U.S.-China trade tensions. And so I'm confused and concerned about the apparent inability of Beijing to react to these more smartly.
Yeah, it's really puzzling the inaction that we've seen. Although, I mean, I think it's fair to say that the decision not to act may be the strategy they're deliberately pursuing right now. But it strikes me that Beijing has definitely missed opportunities to de-escalate. Do you think that it is a deliberate decision? Do you think that maybe the idea is that by not acting. It proves that Beijing really does respect, to some extent, Hong Kong's autonomy. Is this all calculated, or are they actually just, you know, paralyzed, overtaken by events, and maybe really frustrated by the lack of any good options?
Yeah, the idea that Beijing is giving space to Hong Kong to deal with this on its own and as a slight recognition of its autonomy strikes me as implausible given the stakes here.
That's sort of how they're spinning it.
Oh, without a doubt.
Right.
But we also see leaked comments by Carrie Lam to the effect of, you know, I don't have much political room here, you know, to move. So I think
those could be viewed as self-serving too, though.
Okay. I think in the broad picture, it's very unlikely that Beijing has suddenly decided that it's going to give a high degree of autonomy to the government of Hong Kong to deal with what is arguably the most significant crisis the city has dealt with since 2003, maybe, with the National Security Bill, which was shelved. It's much more likely, or the Occam's razor here is that, you know, Beijing has no good options. And certainly as it looks at the world and looks at its base political lines, even though I think if they had conceded on the shelving of this controversial extradition bill in let's say, June.
Right, before June 12.
Before, I certainly think that could have had the impact of a slight gut punch to a building momentum behind some of the more activist protesters.
Could have taken some of the air out of it.
Yeah. Problem is, I bet you at that time when Beijing was thinking about its decision, you know, its choices, a concession of that magnitude would have been perceived as being, if anything, weak and more likely that was only going to incentivize more aggressive demands by the protesters.
Certainly
I think that's how Beijing looked at it.
After June 12th, that certainly would have been the case. After the LegCo takeover,
right,
they certainly
right.
would have seen it that way.
So I think as Beijing was looking at it, a concession was an untenable response. The problem is, though, I bet now they wish they had a time machine, because even if that would have been, from Xi Jinping's perspective, a weak concession, it's sure as heck better than the option set they have now, where this is metastasized into a full-blown political movement that has nationalist undertones with, or overtones, I should say, with things like a national anthem, now has dragged in, you know, you've got the U.S. Congress paying attention to it, and now this is severely impacting the prospects for a loss for DPP President Tsai Ing-wen on Taiwan. So if they think the option set is bad now, this is making a concession earlier on certainly would have been a better play.
Right. A lot of observers have said that we should expect Beijing to do something ahead of October 1st, which is just, you know, coming up in a couple of days, the celebration, of course, for the 70th anniversary of the founding of the PRC. Others have said they're going to hold off until afterward. Do you think the anniversary date matters at all in Beijing's calculus?
Yeah, that would be some pretty piss-poor decision-making if they had this very artificial symbolic deadline of October 1st in a parade. The party has shown that it's willing to withstand international opprobrium if it feels like it's a core interest. They're going to make a calculation on Hong Kong based on the events on the ground in Hong Kong, not based on, look, yes, it will be embarrassing if there's a million people on the streets on October 1st. That would absolutely not be the way that they wanted to celebrate. But the audience for October 1st is primarily domestic. It will be the only thing that people will be following, or at least will be on, coming out of the propaganda organs. They can weather a protest there, and they're certainly not going to preemptorily make a move simply because of that day.
What about the other option, the other obvious option, which is let's just wait it out? They see things starting to fizzle out. I think you mentioned that part of the reason that Denise Ho, Nathan Law, and Joshua Wong are here in town at all is, well, because they feel like support might be flagging.
Yeah, I certainly think that's Beijing's preferred tactic here, partly because that's what worked in 2014.
Mm-hmm.
You saw after 3 months or so, with some specific discrete measures on the ground, we should say, that the Hong Kong government was using to impede the ability of further protests or demonstrations to take place through administrative measures. But nonetheless, if you're Beijing, I think one of the reasons you've been delaying is because time has typically worked on your side,
right?
People get tired. You wait them out. They go back to school. The movement peters out. I think what's different this time, though, is there's elements of the protest movement which know this as well, and they understand that the only way you keep momentum behind the movement is to continue to escalate. And that's where, if I can quote from a great piece that Richard Bush at Brookings Institution wrote, you've got sort of two hardline sides of this who would rather fight than win. And by win, he means find some sort of workable concession. And so even if the majority of protesters are much more pragmatic in what they're hoping to get out of this, you can see a circumstance where more radical elements on both sides, but more radical elements are really driving the forward momentum and where this goes. And look, the muscle memory of the Communist Party, when it feels threatened, is it will use violence.
Thank God that option hasn't been exercised yet. I mean, it's a cliche question by now, but where do you put the odds of that?
Very low.
Right.
And I think for multiple reinforcing reasons, that's going to be the option of last resort. But before I say those reasons, Beijing clearly feels like the use of force is a credible threat, which is why it put People's Armed Police troops. Like, it's a remarkable statement, and it's a remarkable thing that in 2019 we were even having a debate on whether or not China is, CCP is going to use troops or paramilitary on citizens in an international city like Hong Kong. That's pretty extraordinary. And that's not made up, because they were making sure that everyone understood that was the use of force was on the table, hence the show of PAP. There's a lot of reasons why they don't want to do this. I think, first of all, is even if you have a fairly pessimistic outlook on the decision-making of the Communist Party, I don't think they go around looking for instances to unleash violence on the Chinese people. They would much rather find a way to strangle the movement, to wait out the movement. There's also, look, this would be a nightmare if using the local garrison of PLA troops, or sending in, even if it's a limited, tactical squad of PAP to take over critical infrastructure like the airport, that would be a Rubicon moment for public perception and international perception about China. I mean, that would have such a knock-on effect here in the United States. Whether they wanted to or not, that would be framed as Tiananmen 2.0.
Sure.
That would seal the deal on Taiwan, not just for this election, but maybe permanently. Second thing is, and this is much more cynically speaking, but Hong Kong is the great facilitator of ill-begotten Communist Party wealth, both as a store and as a transfer mechanism. And to quote from my colleague Scott Kennedy, if you thought the Panama Papers had some interesting stuff, wait till you see some of the papers and some of the law firms and banks that are in Hong Kong. You remember, right, the New York Times got blocked in Hong Kong for one story about Wen Jiabao's wealth.
David Barbosa's piece
together through publicly available records, a lot of those corporate records in Hong Kong. Imagine if we had the non-publicly available ones. So I think there's a lot of reasons why Beijing is doing everything it can to put that off. I think, to be absolutely clear, though, if they feel like they've got an increasingly radical movement which is articulating increasingly nationalist or statehood aims, and that they don't have any good options, international opprobrium is better to deal with than an insurrection at your southern border.
Mm. And we have talked a little bit about how some of these prominent participants in the protests see things. I would refer everyone to the Hong Kong on the Brink podcast if you want a deeper dive into that and give that a good listen. One thing, though, that doesn't get talked about much is how ordinary Chinese people in the PRC, but also PRC nationals living abroad, how they tend to see things. I want to suggest that whether you're part of this protest, if you're somebody who's broadly sympathetic to its goals, it would help the cause, one would think, to win over some sympathies from mainlanders for a whole bunch of different reasons. I've seen many people argue pretty passionately that there is, in fact, a deep well of sympathy for the protesters within mainland China, and that it's only censorship or fear of authorities that keeps mainlanders from openly expressing their solidarity. It's obvious to me that there are some people. I mean, we had that famous MMA fighter who, for example, came out and boldly, made a statement of support. He got some coverage for that. But I think it's a stretch to say that support is really widespread. I mean, even taking into account, like I said, how hard it would be for anyone to sort of, have the guts to openly express that kind of support, just from my own admittedly small core sample, I mean, if I can extrapolate from that at all, I think the opposite's true. Part of this, for sure, is, censorship, it's partially propaganda, decades of patriotic education. But I actually think there's something pretty infantilizing about saying that, you know, Chinese people only have these attitudes because of this. That just isn't the case. There are many people who've lived abroad for 20, 30 years who are showing up at these rallies in Vancouver, in Australia, and you know, singing the national anthem and that duel of anthems that we're seeing happening in cities around the place. You know, this nonsense to me about the National Endowment for Democracy and foreign black hands, sure, that clearly comes from propaganda. You know, it's honest to God fake news, that stuff. But look, I don't think those things alone explain what I am seeing, what I'm hearing from the many Chinese people that I speak to about this. So first, Jude, what's your sense of how prevalent sympathy is for the Hong Kong protesters among mainlanders, and how that compares, like, proportionately to apathy or outright hostility?
I think certainly going back to the 1990s, but even further back, we've always been surprised in the West, in the United States, when we see widespread organic nationalism in China. But especially after 1989, we've had this really uncomfortable and, I think, dishonest framing or unfair framing of nationalism, as you say, is always the product of top-down propaganda.
Right.
And obviously, when you speak to a wider selection of individuals, you see that there's an incredibly complicated discussion about China's national identity, its national interests, and how issues of foreign policy tie into those. And it was my great education on this was when I 20 years ago, when I first went to China as a student, I was always surprised. I'd be sitting down with these, you know, latte sipping liberals who read F.A. Hayek, but then would be talk about Taiwan independence, and they would, you know, their hackles would go up, and you'd see a completely
the fire breathing dragon comes
out.
Yeah,
and that was a really interesting education for me about the complexity of nationalism. And I just look, I think of this as from a core national identity perspective. It's absolutely understandable how an individual, a Chinese individual, a student studying abroad, for example, looks at this issue and has a very different reaction than I do or someone from Hong Kong does in terms of how they frame it, how the issue is being framed. Pro-independence movements, right, are perceived by the area that you're trying to carve off from. In order to have a successful sort of pro-independence narrative, you need to paint the place that you're trying to leave from as incredibly negatively as possible.
Of course.
Right? It has to be just the epitome of evil and everything wicked in this world. That reverberates back in the home country, right, where people are now struggling with support for some of the aims of the protesters, for example, and probably having many of the same frustrations about political autonomy, rule of law, transparency. But nonetheless, this is all being framed in a way that is China has to be seen as the bad guy here. And so you can understand rightly or wrongly, whether you disagree or agree, how that reverberates out through the China community and mainland community who are in country and living abroad. And so to your point, I think to expect that, and we haven't seen it, that there'd be some sort of widespread sympathy here on behalf of the goals of the protesters, which is saying we want to basically leave the country that you're from and you live in,
right,
would not be treated in the way that many had hoped it would be treated.
It's delusional.
Yeah, I, you know,
that sounds very uncharitable, but I feel like I see this a lot.
I think it's an unrealistic expectation of empathy, let me put it that way, to assume you're going to have widespread or even large support in mainland China,
right,
for the aims of Hong Kong. And as you say, we were talking about this offline, but you know, folks from the mainland who go to Hong Kong, I think, still say, this ain't that bad. You know, what the heck
are
you complaining about here? And I'm not saying that's the right way to think about it, but I am saying that's a look, I've been
hearing
that.
Let's do this whole exercise. Let's walk through
this. For two decades,
I've been hearing
that,
yeah,
which is,
I think this is very useful, though. I mean, what we should do here at this point is let's talk about what that mainlander perspective is, if for no other reason, as a foundation for, you know, like, you got to give a little empathy to get a little empathy.
If I were to simplify, which is a not a particularly helpful thing to do, but nonetheless, let's simplify. Prior to even the protests in 2014, right, before things really kicked off,
right,
here's how I would summarize, broadly speaking, attitudes, at least amongst my circle of friends from China, about Hong Kong. One, a secret envy of Hong Kong because things were really good there in terms of the legal system, in transparency, judicial independence, quality of products, you know. But you had to keep that idea a little bit in check because you also had you were frustrated a little bit about how many of the Hong Kongers flaunted it in front of you, right? Treated people coming in from the mainland as, you know, tubaoza or you know, as crowding our subways or, you know, making life miserable for us.
Buying up all our milk powder, taking up our hospital beds.
And this really, you know, I remember, you know, for a while, you know, well before the tensions really became, I think, severe, you know, you had already a complicated perspective from the mainland about Hong Kong. And anytime you have any, you know, any movement that is or group that is looking to cleave off of the core political unit, this is just basic tribal reaction, which is hostility and skepticism. And right. It takes a remarkable feat, again, as I said, of political empathy to put aside your national tribal identity and to broadly to empathize. And as you say, there are absolutely mainland individuals who are doing this, but I wouldn't say it's widespread.
The other thing that I mean, I think this is a baseline for the attitudes of a lot of mainlanders is simply that, look, before the handover, Hong Kong was simply this glaring vestige of a very shameful colonial past, right? That it was a reminder of this humiliation that China had undergone because of its own weakness since the mid-19th century. And there is this sense that its return in 97 was the righting of this longstanding historical wrong. I mean, that is like it's hard to get past that. I think, like as you said, most mainlanders honestly believe, whether it's, and often it's because of the evidence of their own eyes. They've gone there. They've seen what's for sale in China, in Hong Kong bookstores. They've seen, you know, they've had Falun Gong people walk up to them and talk to them and stuff. That these things that would never happen. Yeah. So they believe that Beijing has made a good faith effort to maintain that level of political autonomy. They don't go deeper. They don't look at a lot of the other issues. But of course, there's a lot of selection bias going on.
Yeah, and again, you know, but target the other way. There's a significant level of censorship right now on discussion of Hong Kong in the mainland.
That's so, right.
I think what we're basically settling on is there was already a long and complicated perspective by the mainland on Hong Kong, and we shouldn't expect widespread support. But nonetheless, Beijing is clearly worried enough about how high the levels of support are where it's willing to put its shoulder into making sure those discussions are scrubbed.
Right. That's no doubt about that. One thing that's become very clear to me is that both sides of this, both the mainlanders and the Hong Kongers, believe that when they're going after the other side, they're punching up, mm-hmm. right? You know, we don't like to see people punch down, and most people, you know, think that punching down is wrong, but that punching up is somehow justified, and that's precisely what they both think they're doing. Mainlanders are convinced that Hong Kongers have this, you know, sense of their own superiority. They've always been privileged, spoiled, maybe, and that, you know, hitting them is in no sense punching down. And then Hong Kongers, you know, just as rightly believe that the mainland, with its sheer size, its now, you know, economic clout, and of course its you know, preponderant balance of force of coercion, that they're punching up when they go after the mainland. So both of them are quite convinced that they're punching up. What do you think of that? I mean, do you think that dynamic really feeds into this feeling of aggrievement and self-righteousness on both sides?
Yeah, although as you're framing the question, the only thing I was thinking, though, is there really is, though, an asymmetry of actors here, because if this was simply a sort of mainland Chinese people and Hong Kong Chinese people, that would feel like an apples-to-apples discussion.
Right.
But really, the what we're talking about, and this is maybe when I'll betray my own sort of perspective on this, but this is much more in the hands of, this is essentially the protesters in Hong Kong and certain elements in the Hong Kong government and back in Beijing. And so that's why I think if I were to, I take your point, but I think in terms of who's punching up, it's the protesters who are dealing with a much more—
Of course, overwhelming.
Overwhelming show of force. But I do take your point that both sides are convinced of their, you know, of their rightness in this.
Let's talk a little bit about media coverage that's been given to events in Hong Kong. I think we can all we can pretty quickly dispense with the coverage such as it is from
Hu Xijin's on the ground reports.
Yeah, Chinese state media, you know, has been especially execrable on covering Hong Kong. I'm sure if Jeremy were here, he'd have some choice adjectives and intensifiers that I would be obliged to beep. But what about coverage from major English language outlets? Have you seen any conspicuous bias, any blind spots, evidence of obvious agendas? Have you seen particularly laudable coverage by any media outlet that's been, you know, really, really in depth and has done a very praiseworthily fair job?
I think one of the problems with being extremely online, and I wouldn't say I'm extremely online, but I'm enough online, is I'm on Twitter, and that's where I get a lot of my coverage in a sense. I mean, this has really been this is not new to have the sort of revolution being tweeted, but this is this is where I think a lot of us are now increasingly getting our information on it. And so what's been interesting and difficult for me is when journalists and think tankers, for that matter, as well, tweet, you get much more of their personal opinion intermingled with what looks like the raw collection of information for their more formal reports.
Right.
And this is just an issue we're all going to have to think through now, because structurally and commercially, you know, journalists are increasingly incentivized to be having an individual brand,
right,
that exists on Twitter and you can take with you from outlet to outlet if you move. And so this is much more personal reporting, as much as it is more institutional reporting than on your platform.
And there's one reporter in particular I want to talk about with regard to that, but let's get to her in a second. But please,
yeah, and so I feel like, given that the press is so under fire right now here in the United States and internationally, I don't want to spend time sort of calling people out. I do just want to call attention to that point, though. And I think we were talking about this before. I think it's my job, just as a think tanker, as much as I can, to not sort of tip my cards and show on a given issue, you know, which side I come down on, because I think that that absolutely biases the way that the information is consumed by people. And it's a fiction, for sure. We all have a personal opinion. The Edward R. Murrow sort of generation of journalists, or the Walter Cronkite, but these are the, you know, completely objective arbiters of the absolute truth. That's gone. But I still respect—
If it was ever there.
I respect the convention. And so this is just, I'd say that what we're seeing in Hong Kong, especially given just how extraordinarily divisive the issue is, where you have, you know, reporters from not propaganda workers for state apparatuses, but reporters from the mainland who are working for foreign outlets who are reporting on the ground, and you have Hong Kong reporters reporting on the ground. And it's hard, I mean, you can't imagine, it's impossible to not have a dog in that fight and to not have an opinion on it. And I think Twitter blurs the line that is a little bit uncomfortable for me in terms of where someone comes down on it.
See, I mean, I think it's a very different animal when you're doing that, when you're tipping your hand, when you're talking to a domestic audience about a domestic story. It's a different game, because there is this sort of a broader understood context. But when you're talking about something that's happening on the other side of the world, which is just extraordinarily complex, it's not as black and white as is often presented.
Yeah.
I think journalists are even under a greater obligation to try to do that Cronkite, that Murrow thing, and introduce a little more context and try to be a little more deliberately impartial.
Yeah, so when I'm not on Twitter and I'm just reading straight news coverage, I continually am amazed at how high quality the work that is being done now across the board on just a series of extraordinary difficult challenges and extraordinary difficult reporting circumstances. You know, just reporting in mainland China right now is so difficult. You know, our Chun Han Wang, you know, from the Wall Street Journal was just sent packing for his work, and he was one of the more, you know, careful, thoughtful reporters on Chinese politics. But the point being, you're just not allowed to report on politics in China anymore. So I want that to be the kind of headline here. That being said, it's really when we go onto Twitter that I think we need new rules of engagement for all of us who are in this professional space of talking about, you know, these issues. How do we do so in a way that Absolutely, you've got your First Amendment rights. No one's challenging that. I think this is more a professional code as much as it is anything. And when the two bleed together, again, as both married to a journalist, but also a consumer of journalism, this is where I get 99% of my information. This matters deeply to me.
That's right.
But I think we're seeing in Hong Kong the stressing of that dual life of I'm a print journalist by day, and then by night I tweet my opinions.
Mm. Before we talk about what's happened to Jiang Fan, which is where I want to go with this, let's talk a little bit about the SCMP, which is an interesting position, of course, which is has long been the English language paper of record in Hong Kong. But of course, it was acquired by Alibaba. There was a lot of skepticism about how its coverage would be. How have they fared since this happened, since this broke out, not just in their coverage, but also on the balance in the editorial page?
I view the SCMP the same way that I view the Wall Street Journal. When I stay away from the editorials, I'm extraordinarily impressed about the high level of reporting that's happening. When I see some of the editorials, that's when it, this morning I rolled my eyes, at a piece. Also, by the way, I was on the main page, the online page today, and the above the fold piece that they had, their most prominent piece was about how a former activist, I think, or someone who was involved in the real Baltic Way back in '89 was saying how in a written interview how the current Hong Kong way is dissimilar and they should not even be pretending to make a connection.
Wow.
That's a little bit too much like a Global Times story for me.
Yeah, it's a little bit too much editorializing
Zooming back, I think the South China Morning Post, to give credit, has been doing some of the, especially since the 19th Party Congress, when there was some, since the 19th Party Congress, they've been doing some of the best reporting on China and on U.S.-China relations.
But I'm asking specifically about Hong Kong and the protests, their coverage of the protests.
Yeah, I'm skating around that. It's a difficult position for them to be in. I think their coverage of it has been, I don't know. I don't know if I have a good answer for this one.
Okay, fair enough. I'll let you go.
Yeah, I don't have a good answer.
Let's get back to
because, I know a lot of those folks, and I just feel crappy.
I think we can leave it at the Wall Street Journal analogy. I think that's a fair one. Let's talk about what happened to Jiang Fan. You've probably followed that whole adventure on Twitter. Jiang's a good friend of ours, or of mine anyway. I don't know if you guys know each other.
Don't know.
Okay. She's been on the show a couple of times. She's a correspondent, of course, for The New Yorker. Terrific writer. She was recently dispatched to Hong Kong for the magazine. She talked about how her Chinese face and her Mandarin had proven to be a liability for her. She actually had some pretty nasty encounters with protesters who were suspicious of her because, she was speaking Mandarin from the moment she landed. I actually called her earlier today. I wanted to run this by with her and, give her a heads up that we would be talking about her. And I just wanted to make sure that I had some of the facts right. So what's your take on the whole thing? I mean, did it reveal, as some people have suggested, ugly truths about the protests? Was it justifiable, as other people have said, the suspicion given what the protesters have experienced with agent provocateurs or with undercover mainlanders or whatever, what have you. What was your sense of that? It's a tough one.
Yeah, well, so the video footage that she put on Twitter, which is irrespective of how you come down on this or how you're looking at this, just on a personal level, to see an individual scrutinized purely because of the language that they speak or the way they look is indefensible. And I think we're getting into this very difficult period with not only the issue of Hong Kong but also U.S.-China relations where we even in this larger context of these political issues, keeping track of our humanity is going to become so fundamentally important. So on a human level, there's no argument or excuse for being accosted on the street, even in the context of Fu Guoyao, the Global Times reporter, who folks were saying you were sending in propaganda workers. He was the one that was detained at the airport. In another shameful,
detained. My God,
in another shameful
beaten,
moment, which again, say. In irrespective of your frustration and anger at the Communist Party and the undefensible tactic of embedding and using Communist Party in ways that subvert, I think, normal rules of open societies. Keeping track of your humanity is going to be crucial. Now, what I thought was interesting with her experience, though, is she also came out of that saying her faith and support and love of Hong Kong throughout the entire visit was enriched. That she came away with such a positive feeling about the city. And so what I think this really gets to is, and why this is so important, is what's happening in Hong Kong is really a battle for narratives, right? Both sides are trying to gain the moral high ground, which is why you see state propaganda from Communist Party looking at instances of violence and trying to extrapolate and generalize those to the whole movement.
Right.
You see on the other side, you see actions by the police, again, undeniably violent actions, indefensible actions being extrapolated to the entire police. I should say, as an American, though, watching how the Hong Kong police have conducted themselves is quite remarkable.
Yeah,
But really nonetheless, restrained. This isn't America, and so we have different expectations. So these events and instances are important because both sides are looking to weaponize them. And what's difficult for folks who aren't on the ground is to get a sense of proportion, right? So on the issue of violence, for example, we've got millions of Hong Kong people who are participating in these. I think we know that this is a small number of individuals who are engaged in the much more radical violent as a fraction of the overall number of people who are participating, broadly speaking, in the movement. On the police, though, I think we can say the same thing, that of the overall 30,000 plus police members in Hong Kong, the more sort of offensive and aggressive actions are not indicative of the entire police force, but both sides are trying to really sort of crank up the narrative to paint the opposing side as either bloodthirsty cops or reckless rampaging protesters. And that's why instances like Jiang's, confrontation with the group of individuals is important on a human level, but also plays into this larger story of narrative.
That's
and,
right.
And for folks who are trying to say, and I saw this on Twitter, of, aha, you see, protesters are bigoted, the protesters are xenophobic, this story played into that narrative.
Right. That is something that I think needs to be more squarely addressed as well. But again, that's only a piece of this. Focusing exclusively on that would be just as wrong. It's a very complicated thing. Something that Jiang actually wrote in a couple of her tweets, though, plays into what we were talking about earlier about the positioning that journalists should take, the stance that they should take. And she had said, she talked about how, I want to make clear that I stand with Hong Kong and its struggle for freedom, which struck a lot of people, as you can imagine it would, as just affirming this narrative that they've convinced themselves of, that Western media organizations have an inherent inextricable bias on behalf of the protesters. Now, I asked Jiayang about this today, and she said, I want to make it clear, I did not say I stand with the protesters. She said she wanted to make this more broad and to be talking about generally her deep concerns about the encroachment on Hong Kong's autonomy, as was promised, the extradition bill, the thing that everyone's already forgotten about that started this whole thing off. But she brought that up explicitly, saying that she opposed the extradition bill. This was not about solidarity with any group of protesters. So just to make that clear. And I think that's fair enough to say. She also said, and I think it's fair, in that moment, she felt like she needed to say that. She needed to really make it clear that she wasn't a plant there to embarrass or to humiliate or to expose bad behavior by the protesters.
Well, look, the other thing too is all of these events and instances are extraordinarily messy and don't fit into a black and white dichotomy of angels on one side and devils on the other, right? And that's where it's a bizarre development that we're seeing, and I think especially on Twitter, but the broader narrative on a lot of these geopolitical issues and domestic political issues of the inability to deal with complexity. And this has always been a struggle. George Orwell said the most difficult thing your writer has to do is acknowledge the truth right in front of their nose. So moral clarity and comfort with complexity has always been very, very difficult.
Right.
But we now have tools and technologies which I think even strip away even more so our ability to deal with these complexities when it's either short form 140 tweet or we've got sort of images going viral and doing a lot of the work for us in terms of thinking these through. But as with our conversation today about just for a moment, even if like me, you have a understanding of how the Communist Party acts as a more fundamentally illiberal political entity, that doesn't mean, therefore, that we throw away our ability to sort of sit in the shoes of a party secretary or of a mainlander who's looking down at the protests in Hong Kong and thinking for a moment, how are they viewing this?
That's right.
And that's not saying you agree with them. That's not saying screw
exactly.
Hong Kong.
It's back to cognitive empathy, yeah. Which is what I'm all about that. But, you know, to your point about moral clarity, I think a lot of us suffer from this. Those of us who are sort of in the nuancers camp, we may drown ourselves in this bucket of gray paint, right? I mean, we've all developed this sort of ability to play ourselves to a stalemate in the kind of mental chess when we do kind of sit here on one side of the board and then, you know, to the other side. And we're good at that, and that's good. But sometimes, I mean, there is that threat of losing moral clarity.
Yeah, and I not to stray too far from the topic at hand here, but I think more broadly, actually, I will stray because the issue of U.S.-China relations is central to how a lot of us or why a lot of us are, you know, why the U.S. government is paying attention to events in Hong Kong. The two are tied. But I think these issues are now increasingly being the camps are, do you think fundamentally that the blame or the responsibility lies with the United States to fix things, or do you think the blame or responsibility lies with the Communist Party to fix things?
Right.
And so I think maybe even you and I may come down slightly different on that one.
I'm sure we do.
May lean a little bit more towards the Communist Party, but I think we need to really be comfortable or we need to recognize that this is a big discussion, and by Hua Qifeng, let 100 flowers bloom. And even if we come down in different parts of that divide on where responsibility lies, having much more empathy for the number of players who can be a part of that discussion, I think, is going to be imperative moving forward. And we're way too quick. We're way too much on the moral druthers and judgment than we are on this empathy and ability to recognize and understand the standing of people who come from different positions on the debate.
That's right. I think, you know, many of the people, I think, in our circle, at least, people who are in this little organization that you and I are part of, we recognize the magnitude of the problems that we have with China. We recognize China's culpability in a lot of this. We recognize that a lot of them are rooted in fundamental values differences with a country who, as we both, you know, very plainly recognize, is deeply illiberal. It has values that are very much at odds with our own. But we don't necessarily think that the way to solve them is to be just aggressively confrontational necessarily, or not across the board in any case. And I think we are still committed to diplomacy. We still are committed to exercising this cognitive empathy. Anyway, Jude, your words of wisdom are always very, very welcome here. I'm glad that we could have this conversation about this very difficult subject. So a pleasure to talk to you as always. Let's move on to recommendations. First, though, I want to remind our listeners that the Seneca podcast is powered by SubChina. If you like what we're doing with Seneca and with the other shows in the Seneca network, the very best way you can support our work is to subscribe to SubChina's daily newsletter. This thing is just chock full of really, really good reads on China delivered to your inbox every weekday. So Jeremy, Lucas, Jiayuan, they just do amazing work. They work very, very hard, very long hours to bring you what I think is a fine, fine product. It's just a good value for money. So sign up and spread the word. On to recommendations. Jude, Jeremy's not here, so you go first. What do you have for us?
An essay written by the estimable Richard Bush, who's now at Brookings Institution, who I had the pleasure of getting to know last summer when I traveled to Taiwan with him. People think of Richard as a Taiwan expert, but he attended high school in Hong Kong and has written a great book about Hong Kong after the umbrella protests. But I want to recommend a shorter essay he wrote a couple weeks ago, called Hong Kong, How Hong Kong Got to This Point.
Mm-hmm.
It's available on the Brookings Institution website. Richard is, I think, a model of someone who has both moral clarity on where the right side of values are, but also a really distinct ability to understand both sides of the argument. And he writes a very nice short essay, which for those of you looking for a good primer or looking to share a good primer with people who are trying to understand some of the complexity of Hong Kong today, I think this is a great place to start.
That's fantastic. That's great. My recommendation, I don't know if you've read this yet, but Our Man, Richard Holbrooke and the End of the American Century by George Packer. Did you get to this yet?
No.
Oh my God, it's fantastic. Just absolutely, I'm recommending to everybody. Exemplary biography. It's just written so well. Holbrooke in all of his complexity, warts and all, just and I mean, there are warts. What a life. What an amazing person. What a fascinating character study. So yeah, I highly recommend it. It really is just an overview of the last 50 years, or the entire, really, from the late 50s all the way up until his fairly recent death, looking at all the events that he played such a critical part in, from Vietnam, where he was for very many years, all the way through the Afghan War. So thanks a lot, Jude. That was just great, man. It's always great to have you.
Thank you.
The Seneca Podcast is powered by SubChina and is a proud part of the Seneca Network. Our show is produced by Kaiser Guo and Jeremy Goldcorn, with editing help by Jason McRonald. Drop us an email at seneca@subchina.com. Follow us on Twitter or on Facebook at SubChina News. And make sure to check out our other podcasts, the Caixin Seneca Business Brief, the Pan Daily Tech Buzz China, China Econ Talk, which I must say has just been particularly good recently. Make sure to check out a double issue that with Julia Lovell about Maoism. We have two shows focused on women, New Voices and Ta for Ta, also a fantastically good show, and the Middle Earth Podcast on the culture industry in China. I do not want to leave out our brand new family member, Strangers in China, which just debuted last week. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week. Take care.